Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel and the Opel Commercial Vehicles Range. We have your van.
My newsroom colleague Laura Hogan is reporting at the moment that the number of people in hospital with the virus has risen overnight to 354. It was 349 at 8 o'clock last night. And the number of patients who tested positive for COVID-19 who were admitted to intensive care remained stable at 38. They're not having such a stable time of it elsewhere in Europe. It seems that we are very much obviously in the throes of a second wave with 1.3 million new cases reported across the continent last week alone. Some countries faring better than others, though. For more, I'm joined by Darren McCaffrey, political editor with Euronews. Good morning, Darren. Oh, we're having all sorts of problems with the lines this morning. Darren, can you hear me?
I can indeed. Can you hear me okay?
Absolutely perfectly now. Thank you very much. You're in Belgium, where the situation is pretty grim. There's something of a doctor and nurse shortage.
Yeah, really, really grim here, not just in terms of case numbers, which are running around 18,000 cases a day. Just to put that in perspective, of course, you know, Belgium is only 2.5 times the size of Ireland. So 18,000 cases a day, 600 hospital admissions a day. That's up from around 100 a day back at the start of October. And it's got to the point where hospitals now really are struggling to cope. There's over 1,000 people in intensive care beds. They're literally running out of capacity and also running out of doctors and nurses. In some parts, particularly in southern Belgium, around 20% of staff are off ill with sickness, and they're struggling to replace them. And even though we know this time round, the doctors and nurses say that they can save many more lives than they could in the first wave because they've got much better at treating coronavirus, the fear here now is that actually they're going to have to make those choices again about who lives and dies, simply because they haven't got the capacity, either with hospital staff or beds, to treat them. Many people now, Philip, are comparing what's happening in Belgium, particularly in Wallonia, the French-speaking part in the south, and here in Brussels, to northern Italy and to Bergamo back in the spring. That's how bad, how grim things are here.
And I gather that the Belgians have asked the Dutch, would they be able to take in some of their extra patients, but the Netherlands has declined.
Yeah, indeed. You know, there was lots of speculation at the end of last week that Belgium would reach this point. We would have to ask its neighbours if it could transfer patients to other countries. It did ask the Netherlands yesterday. The Netherlands essentially said no, because we're in a pretty difficult situation as well. Our beds are starting to fill up. Case numbers are pretty high in the Netherlands too. It must be remembered, though, that first time round, when the Netherlands asked to do it, to send their patients to Belgium, Belgium also said no. But, you know, we're essentially in a bit of a lockdown here, lockdown light to a degree, not quite as harsh as it is in Ireland. You know, bars and restaurants are closed, gyms, cinemas, theatres are closed, people told to limit their social contacts. But there's lots of speculation that this weekend that Belgium is going to have to effectively go into a national lockdown like it did in the spring, with all shops closed and with people told not to go outside their homes unless it's necessary or to exercise.
Take us through what's happening in other European, Western European countries.
Well, it's really interesting that, you know, clearly, particularly the UK was very badly hit first time round. It seems to be faring much better compared to most other big European countries this time round. We look at France, it's talking about having 100,000 infections within the next couple of weeks per day. Again, concerns about hospitals, particularly in the Paris region, that they could be overrun. Unrelated surgery and medical activities there have been cancelled. You know, Italy has seen violence on the streets of Milan and Turin last night over, again, lockdown measures there to try and curb the number of infections. People not terribly happy about having facilities and shops and restaurants closed early. But the real damage or the real impact this time round actually is proving to be in Eastern Europe, which wasn't particularly badly hit first time round. In places like the Czech Republic, they really are struggling. They've just opened 500 beds. A tented hospital outside Prague because their hospitals are on the verge of collapse. And the same in Poland, that has seen, you know, very, very dramatic increases in the death rate in Poland. Again, a reminder that in Central and Eastern Europe, they don't, you know, in the capacity is pretty good here in Belgium. It's got one of the best healthcare systems in the world. It cannot cope at the moment. In Eastern Europe, it's even more dire because they just don't have the facilities. And in fact, Austria and the Netherlands sent 150 ventilators to the Czech Republic only this weekend to try and help them out. And it must be said, even in Germany, which again has fared pretty well, they are starting to be concerned. You've got over 10,000 cases a day there. And it's not because they got a shortage of beds. Again, it comes back to this idea of staff. There's concern that they just do not have enough staff. And coming back again to Belgium, you know, that's the thing, is that, you know, you can have all the equipment in the world, and some degree you can have extra capacity. And Belgium does have a degree of capacity. What it's concerned about is staff. Is one doctor put it in a hospital in Liège, Philip. He said that, you know, first time round, we were concerned that we didn't have enough PPE. We didn't have enough gowns or masks or medical equipment. This time round, we've got all the equipment. We just don't have enough staff to put it on.
Indeed. All right, Darren McCaffrey, thank you very much. Let's drill down into that, because it would be very much the case that you can have all of the ICU beds in the world, but if you don't have the doctors and nurses to staff them, well, then you're not in a very healthy situation at all. And it would seem that almost a fifth of the staff at one Dublin hospital were found to have coronavirus antibodies after a study was carried out on a representative group of 1,200 staff members. It's a significantly higher number than those who actually tested positive for the virus. For more, I'm joined by Dr. Anna Rose Pryor, consultant microbiologist at Tala University Hospital, where the study was carried out. Anna Rose, can you tell us, please, first of all, what did you look for and what did the study tell you?
Hi, Philip. Good morning. Yes, so what we looked at this study was, it was over a three-month period from July to October. And basically, as you said, we recruited 1,200 of our staff, which represented a third of all the staff in the hospital. And this is a cross-section of staff to all different departments. So staff we consider with more direct patient contact, so your doctors, your nurses, but also those with a lesser level of direct patient contact, so for example, clerical staff and laboratory staff. So we assessed an antibody response in those staff. So we looked for antibodies to coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, to indicate that at some point in the preceding number of months, those staff had had evidence of infection with COVID. So we found that approximately 20% of staff had evidence of a past infection at some period since the onset of the pandemic. And this was significantly higher, as you said, than what we had confirmed via the swab test at some stage during those few months.
There's a number of things that one can conclude from this, and I don't know if I'm right in concluding all of them, but first off, would it be right to say that if one-fifth of the workforce in a very COVID-intense environment have been exposed at some point in the past, that the rate of exposure in the wider community really is only going to be what the modelling suggests at the moment, under 2%?
Yeah, so the dynamics, I suppose, of people working in healthcare settings are quite different to what's going on in the community. So in the healthcare setting, obviously, we've exposure to patients, which is we know there's that risk. And in particular, when we're exposed to patients with COVID, we can take the precautions. And I suppose a lot has changed in the few months, in that we now know as well that patients who are asymptomatic can transmit COVID. So we've taken a lot more precautions there. So there's a high level of exposure to both suspected and unsuspected cases of COVID, but also at a time when the rest of the community has locked down and has minimised their exposures. Our staff would have many both social and professional interactions in the workplace as well. And we do know that it's not just staff acquiring COVID infection from patients, they're also acquiring it from each other too, to the level of interactions in the workplace. So it's very different to compare, obviously, to a community setting. So the workplace interactions, I mean, the assessing here is important as well. We know Dublin was one of the counties earlier on that was most affected, and particularly the Tala area as well, which many of our staff would live in, has been one of the areas in Dublin most affected as well. So we've staff who are living in an area of higher community prevalence, coming into a healthcare setting where they're having multiple interactions with other healthcare workers and patients.
Have you any benchmark here to know if what you're looking at is to be expected in any hospital, particularly like Tala, one that was designated as a COVID hospital quite early on? Or are staff at greater risk of contracting the virus there than you would expect?
I suspect we're probably not too far off what it is in other Dublin hospitals in particular. So there is a study ongoing in both St James's Hospital and Galway Hospital. So that would be our comparative for a similar type hospital, a tertiary care hospital. I would suspect maybe James's aren't too far off us, although that obviously remains to be seen. But like I said, you know, we were dealing with high numbers of patients at a time when, you know, this is a new disease. We've learned a lot more about it. And a lot of these exposures were staff-acquired infection that was unsuspected. Probably happened quite early on when we didn't really fully recognise the risk of asymptomatic spread or some of the atypical symptoms such as loss of smell or even diarrhoea. Patients come in with these things and we didn't recognise that they had COVID. So I would hope going forward that the risk to staff hopefully will reduce as we become a lot more aware of the variant, you know, disease entities.
There's also, isn't there, a worrying discrepancy here between the PCR negative tests that must have been coming back for staff and then these antigen COVID positive tests that are coming back when you went in and did your study, pointing to PCR tests not being that accurate?
So we do know that. We know that our PCR test, and no test is 100% sensitive. And it really depends on the timing for the PCR test. There's a relatively small window period to detect somebody who has COVID infection with a PCR test. If you look too soon or too late, you might get what's called a false negative. So a number of staff, so we know from this study about a third of our staff with antibodies hadn't previously had a confirmed infection. So of that third of staff, they either were never tested or they had a negative test. So, you know, you might kind of get alarmed from that to think, well, actually, a lot of staff had a negative result or didn't realise they had COVID. But I suppose it's a bit more complex than that, in that many of those staff would have had some symptoms that would have been consistent with COVID infection. And, you know, at a time when we wouldn't have had influenza circulating, that we would have known the probability of those symptoms, it probably was COVID. So, in fact, those staff were probably off work anyway because they had symptoms. Or they were off work because they were known to have been in contact with COVID. So many of those staff did suspect that they were either in contact or they had infection. It just wasn't confirmed. So as I said, no test is perfect. So it comes back to what we call the pre-test probability. So if you're a 30-year-old healthcare worker and you develop a temperature and you develop a cough or you lose your sense of smell in the middle of the summer, you know, and even if your test is negative, there's still a very high probability that's due to COVID. So we don't fully depend on tests. Test is part of the picture to help confirm an infection, but we still have to go with our clinical suspicion and clinical assessment.
You have the baseline here for another interesting study in a couple of months' time. Do you intend to go back to all of those people who had COVID antibodies and see if they still have them, if they still might have some degree of immunity 3, 4, 5 months down the line?
Yes, absolutely. So we've recruited these participants for the duration of a year, and we plan to look at them at, I think it's 3, 6 and 12 months. So we have two lots of participants here. We have the ones who we know have antibodies at present, and we'll follow them over the year to see what happens. So will they get reinfected? Will those antibodies persist? And we can see what happens after a year's time. We also have a group of participants who we know have never had antibodies, and we've brought in lots of different measures since the onset of this pandemic. So, you know, we've brought in universal mask wear, we've brought in more widespread testing, and we will see then going forward, are staff less likely now to acquire COVID infection with all these measurements that we've brought in. So we've two groups here to study going forward.
All right. Anna Rose Pryor, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.